Her medical journey began after being hit by a car while riding her bicycle. She never broke any bones, but that trauma manifested in her body as a daily headache. She never felt heard by the physician who examined her after the accident, and from that time forward, resolved to become a caring, compassionate physician who listened attentively to her patients. OMM was her saving grace, and the mentoring of Dr. Ed Stiles inspired her to choose a career path using OMM. Today, she is an OMM residency director, educating and inspiring the next generation of osteopathic physicians. Join my conversation with Dr. Kingery. This is episode 91 of the Osteopathic Manipulative Medicine Podcast, where we share clinical stories and pearls related to osteopathic medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ben Green, a third-year osteopathic neuromusculoskeletal medicine resident at Michigan State University. Our guest is board certified in family practice and neuromusculoskeletal medicine. She has lectured nationally on topics such as rib cage mechanics, sequencing, and on integrating osteopathic care in a rural family medicine residency. She is the co-author and co-editor of the Pocket OMT Manual and is the recipient of the Women in Medicine Top Family Practitioner Award. She currently serves as the program director of the Osteopathic Neuromusculoskeletal Medicine Residency at Ohio Health Obelenus Hospital and also serves as core faculty for the Family Medicine Residency. She is a member and vice chair of the ACGME Review Committee for the Osteopathic ONMM Residencies. Thank you for being on the podcast this evening, Dr. Jennifer Kingery.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
Yes, I greatly appreciate you taking time away from your family and your husband and kids to share your story about how you became interested in medicine and how you became interested in OMM. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah, the honor's all mine. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. I usually like to start getting to know you a little bit as a person. So if you could share with us some of your hobbies or some of your interests outside of your medical practice, that'd be great.
Sure. And let me just start by saying, as a disclosure, that I do sit on the ACGME Review Committee. So anything that I say as part of this podcast is of my own accord and my own practices, and in no way reflects anything from that committee.
Sure. Great.
Yeah. So as far as hobbies, top and foremost is time with my family, my husband and my two boys. I have a 14-year-old and a soon to be 9-year-old. So I'm dealing with a teenager in my house. So that brings lots of fun to the dynamics. So I love time with them and I love to bake. Cooking is just fine, but baking's kind of my big hobby that I really like to do whenever I have a chance to stress reliever. I like to make breads and cakes and cookies and that sort of thing. And of course, the workplaces really like it when I have to do stress relief because then they get to reap the benefits of that.
Yeah. Darn, I wish I was in your residency now.
Well, unfortunately, I don't always have as much time as I would like to do that sort of thing, especially now that school started back and I go home and we have to do homework of the evenings. So, I do what I can, but my husband, his fusses because I don't make things near as much as I used to. And I said, but we're trying to lose weight and be healthy. And if I make bad stuff, then we eat it. And he says, well, that's okay. Then we just have a little bit. Then you can take it to the neighbors.
Yeah, that's a slippery slope.
Yeah.
I have a lot of discipline for that. That's funny. Baking. I'm not much of a baker, but the little baking that I have seen done, it's quite a science, right?
Yes. And I'm really bad to tweak recipes. Like I'll start with a recipe on Pinterest, but then I'll read four or five different variations. And then I come up with the Jennifer variation. Sometimes it works out. Sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah. That's great. Let's switch to a movie or documentary recommendation.
Well, I mean, and I was just thinking in lines of just with osteopathy. I mean, the biggest things in our profession, I think, as DOs, is the autobiography, the philosophy of osteopathy, and the philosophy of mechanical principles and practice by A.T. Still. Not because they're easy to read, but because these are our foundations that A.T. Still built osteopathy around. You know, there are times when it's just difficult to interpret what he's trying to say or what he's trying to get to relay, because there's a difference in the language because of the era of the 1800s versus how we think about things today. And not only that, it's just your mindset of then getting to discover medicines and antibiotics and the importance of sanitary processes. There was not a, you know, wide use or even vaccines to prevent illnesses and diseases. I mean, even A.T. Still lost his first, you know, part of his family to illnesses. So I just think it's such a great start, even though they are very hard to read, to kind of get into the mindset of where this profession came from. You know, A.T. Still was brilliant and years ahead of his time. I mean, he not only saw the vision of our profession, but he turned it to a reality that it's still thriving today. And that's just, it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I need to make a public confession that I haven't read those books yet. I need to.
Oh, well,
I've been dragging my feet.
Yeah, well, it's required as a resident to read at least, it's in the standard, you have to read at least two of them.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see, John Lewis's book, I don't know if you've read it, From the Dry Bone to the Living Man.
I have not read that one.
So John Lewis is I believe he's from Wales. He's an osteopath from Wales who dedicated, I believe, seven years of his life to researching osteopathy and reading the original works of Still and putting it into modern language with stories and anecdotes. So he interviewed all of, not all, but many of the lineage, direct lineage of Still, nephews, nieces, people that knew him in the community in Kirksville, or that knew of him. So it is just a joy to read that book. I couldn't put it down. I think I read it in like 2 days. So I love that book, and I love it because I have read a little bit of Still, and it is sometimes challenging to read. But it's, you're right,
very challenging.
I think there is no doubt there's a lot of wisdom and vision in that. And I think it is important to go back to the original works of the founder of our specialty, of our profession. Absolutely. I feel like I'm talking to Ed Stiles.
Well, you know, he's been my mentor for, 22 years. So he definitely has corrupted my brain in his ways, in many ways. I jokingly call myself stylized. So I have my own style, but I am very much stylized within his paradigm of thinking and in the way that I practice.
Yeah, well, that's great. I had a conversation with Dr. Stiles on the podcast, and it was a joy and a pleasure to talk to him, and I learned so much. I need to bring him back because we need to go over the sequencing a little bit more in depth.
And if you think about Dr. Stiles, I mean, he's, you know, world renowned, and he's one of the greats in the profession, and he has worked with so many of the other greats in the profession. Yes. I don't know, I might be dating myself, but there used to be a saying of like nine degrees to Kevin Bacon, because at one time Kevin Bacon could be linked to so many different movie stars and movies and things. So it's kind of osteopathy, you know, I've jokingly said it's like the 9 degrees of Ed Stiles, and how you have interacted with him or heard his name or seen him at a meeting or a lecture or something.
Yeah, definitely. He is one of the greats. And he was telling me so many incredible stories about osteopathy. You're right, rubbing shoulders with the greats, learning from the greats. Phil Greenman being one of them, taking over a practice in New York from,
Dr. Wilson.
Yeah. Dr. Wilson, right? Who was taking care of all these affluent people in New York City. And that, you know, was just a very fascinating story.
Right, absolutely.
So, okay. Well, switching gears again, what about a, let's see, a book recommendation? I guess you gave us a book recommendation. Move Your Documentary. We haven't touched on that one yet.
Yeah, and I don't know that I can really give you that. I don't.
And that's fine.
I don't really have much time to really watch much movies or documentaries.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah.
No problem.
Well, I live in the world that if anything is going in my house, it's anime or Godzilla or Pokemon.
What your sons are up to, what they're watching?
Yes.
Got it. Let's see. Let's start from how, you know, the beginning, how you became interested in medicine, Dr. Kingery. How did that happen?
Well, that's kind of a long story. So, which, you know, not a lot of people probably know my history, but I was hit by a car when I was 12. We lived in Minnesota at the time. And, you know, I tried to always follow the rules and do what I'm told, but I was only partially going to follow the rules. I was on my way back home from a friend's house to eat supper, and my parents had gotten home from work, and she was coming with me because, you know, we were food, soup, beans, cornbread, all that good stuff, and her mom didn't cook very much. So I went to cross the road, and I was on the shoulder of the road. I stopped to look both ways. She looked both ways and rode on across. But I was going to cheat and ride my bike across instead of walk it like you're supposed to. And I looked to my left, I looked to my right, and then before I could even really turn back, I was flying through the air. A car had passed another car on the shoulder of the road, and they hit my bike, threw me up in the air, and I flipped. My left hip caught the passenger side mirror, pulled it out, bolts and all, and then I landed on my right side. Road. So, you know, from that point on, I didn't break anything. I wish I had have broke something, knowing what I know now, right? All that force went into my system and had no outlet. So the outlet was I started having horrific headaches that, you know, nothing would touch it. Ibuprofen would take the edge off of it, but nothing ever made them go away. So from the time that happened until I started medical school, I did not know what it was to not have a headache. It just varied in its intensity.
Every single day you had a headache.
Yes.
Since that accident.
Yes. Wow. So, you know, and that happened the day after sixth grade for me. I was 12, but then I turned 13 at the end of that month after it happened. So in Minnesota, we never started school till after Labor Day, but I went back to school. And I had a hard time focusing. I couldn't concentrate. I was trying to study. And then it was just my head was, I was really just losing my mind in essence. My parents didn't know what to do. So they got me an appointment with a family medicine doctor, and they took me to him and never touched me, literally never touched me. And I still can see flashbacks of it in my mind. You know, he put a stethoscope to my chest, but never felt my neck, never felt my hip, nothing like that. Just told my parents and me that it was the after effects of the car accident, and wrote Tylenol 3 for me and said if I didn't get better, you know, to come back. Well, Tylenol 3 made me sick as a dog, and I didn't do well with it. And so I just kept taking the ibuprofen. It's a wonder I didn't end up with a stomach ulcer in the mix of it, you know, knowing I know now, because as a child and you hurt, you just are all the time asking for things. They took me back to this physician again, and all he wanted to do was write more Tylenol 3. Never once did he ever discuss with my parents that, you know, I'm suffering post-concussion syndrome, that I had a concussion from this accident, and, you know, nothing with regards to that. They were just at their wit's end. Had a friend of his with his work that had a first cousin that was an orthopedic surgeon, and he called in the favor that he never calls in to see me thank goodness. And I went in there 5 minutes, and he looked at my parents and says, why has this child not been in physical therapy? She's probably got permanent atrophy in her, you know, in her buttocks area now because of this. So I got into physical therapy, learned coping mechanisms, stretching, exercises, to then be able to cope, and started doing better, and just learned to live within the realm that I couldn't remember what it was to not have pain and to not have a headache. So, you know, at that time, you know, that was when I made the vow that I was going to be a doctor. And I told everyone I was going to be a doctor, and I was going to listen to my patients. And I told that for years, you know, because I felt ignored as a patient, as a person. I felt like, you know, my parents didn't know what to do. And if only, you know, if only they had known what osteopathy was and a DO at that time. But at the same time, you know, things have a way of working out the way they needed to. So maybe I had to go through that experience to get me where I am today.
Yeah. So after you started the physical therapy, thanks to your cousin who was an ortho doc, did those headaches become better? Did you stop having daily headaches?
No, until I started getting OMT in medical school, I literally did not know what it was. I just thought it became my normal. And at 12, you know, my memory gets a little foggy about what your thought processes are at that time. But I just learned how to push on. I was very introverted. My children can't believe that now. But at that time, I was very introverted. I hardly, you know, outside of my couple of friends I had, I didn't really participate in anything. I just studied, did my work, went home. You know, I was in bed early, part of that because my parents pushed me to do that, part of that because I would just be physically exhausted every day. But, you know, you just learn it. That's the beauty of being a child, though. Children are so versatile, and they grow and can adapt way better than what we can as adults. So I just learned to deal with it. You know, I had an ultimate goal. I had to keep straight A's, not only because I had determined I wanted to be a doctor and I knew I needed to have good grades, but I always had to work really hard at my grades. I was not naturally smart, and I'm a horrible test taker. But my uncle had promised me when I was 4 years old that if I kept straight A's, he would buy me a car. So I was determined to get my car.
That's a great motivation.
So I was having like major emotional stress because I couldn't focus and my grades were going to fall. I mean, like, that was where my focus was. It could have been a million other places, but it was, you know, even in going into seventh grade was, if my grades fall, I'll never get that car I was promised.
So, wow.
I managed to do it.
Power of motivation.
Yeah, I know. And I did. I managed to keep my straight A's, and I did get my car. It was a little used Hyundai Excel, and I drove it till it wouldn't drive anymore. So I'm forever grateful to him for that.
Now, are you going to do the same thing with your kids? If you keep straight A's, I'm going to get you a car.
Well, I have one child that I'd never work on. He's not my academia child. He's more of a hands-on kind of person. And I have another one that my youngest, he's the exact opposite. So, but that definitely worked on me. It would not have worked on my sister. We're like daylight and dark. But my oldest son reminds me a lot of my sister. So, and there's nothing wrong with that. So,
yeah. It's interesting, right? I mean, every child is unique. And I guess that's the importance maybe of parenting, is trying to figure out what are some good positive reinforcers for each child. And it, like you said, it's probably unique to each individual.
Absolutely. And for me, that's, you know, hard, because the way my oldest son thinks and processes is not how my brain works. So, you know, butting heads with him is part of, you know, butting heads with your kids. But when you're trying to help them learn, and, you know, they have C's, and you're like, but you're so much smarter than a C. But it's realizing that it's so much more than that. And a C, there's nothing wrong with having a C, you know, depending on other things that go on. He suffers from some ADHD, medicines made his, we tried several and they made his tics really bad. And he's learned to control his tics. And we've worked on coping ways to keep our focus. We just have to work a little harder. And, you know, I think it helped me be more understanding of that process and understanding that I have to push him in the ways that he can, you know, thrive, and trying to push him to have straight A's is that's only going to push him away from me and probably actually be, not as good of a student altogether. Mm-hmm. He and I have both grown in that regard. So I think we're in a good place now.
Yeah.
Because starting high school is scary. So he just transitioned in high school, but so far, so good. He's liking all of his teachers. That's, you know, number one hurdle to get over. So hopefully he can keep up with all this homework and things that's going, and hopefully I'll be able to still help him. This new math that they do now, though, my brain can't wrap around it. I'm old school, so you should have phoned some friends on that.
Or look up some YouTube videos, maybe.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And I have to phone my best friend if it's poetry, because me and poetry just, we don't jive. My comprehension of what I'm supposed to get out of it has never been what I'm supposed to get out of it, so... Thank goodness that she's great at it. And this past year, we actually had a FaceTime for an hour and a half, and she helped him through the questions that he had to answer with regards to poems. So
yeah,
that's great. Thank goodness for best friends.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think you touched on some really important points as parents, as physicians, as just people that want to be good members of the community. I think that there's always a global picture when you're looking at a person, you know, and it's so easy to stereotype someone. Let's say they get a C, you're like, oh, you must not be smart. But there's so much more to the picture. Maybe what's going on in the household, maybe some illness, you know. But at the same time, that person also has a myriad of unique qualities and characteristics. You know, that as educators, I think it's important to see that. And I like how you brought that up.
Right. But it's important to the world too, right? We don't all be the same. We don't all need to have to go to college. We need our tradespeople that can work cars and our air conditioning units and build our houses and our buildings. And, you know, we need a little of everything. And it's the same way in medicine. We don't all need to be primary care. We don't all need to be ER doctors. And we don't, you know, like, that's why there's so many different specialties, and it's all the different personalities and your interests that pull you to where you need to be to make us a well-rounded unit to be able to thrive and have all the wonderful things that we have living in, you know, the country that we live in.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're determined to becoming a physician. You decide to go to medical school. Any particular reason why you chose osteopathic medical school?
Well, there's another interesting little story. I went to my undergrad at Concord College. It's now Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. I had no idea what osteopathy was, that it even existed. I just knew I was going to be a doctor. So I was a biology major. The whole science department sponsored like a career fair for your people wanting to go on into postgraduate training. And the West Virginia Osteopathic School had a table set up at this. And I almost did not go to this. I already knew what I wanted to do. I already kind of thought about, I mean, I'm from Virginia. We moved back from Minnesota to Virginia, where my parents are originally from, when I was in my ninth grade year. So I, you know, had a really bad headache that day and I almost did not go, but then my gut said, you need to make yourself go. And I felt like God led me to where I needed to be, because as I was walking to this, the headache significantly let up on me. And so when I was talking to the recruiter that was at that table, and he was explaining to me what osteopathy was and how DOs were different from MDs, like I immediately said, well, this is what I want to do. And I went back to my dorm room that evening. I called my parents and I said to them, I'm going to be a DO, not an MD. And they said, you're going to be a what? I said, I'm going to be a DO. And I said, I just knew in my gut that this was, you know, an answer to so many of the problems I have, but exactly how I envision seeing myself going forward and what I wanted for my career and my little promise to myself that when I was a doctor, I was going to listen to my patients.
What was it about the explanation that they gave that sold you on osteopathic medicine?
Oh my goodness. I have no idea. That's been so long ago. But it was just looking at the musculoskeletal system and how it's an answer to pain and to help people with pain, not an answer to it, but looking at the whole body and how it's interconnected. And that just was, I was just like, well, this is what I need. I need this myself. So, so I set out from then. I didn't apply to anything but DO schools, and I only applied to the Pikeville and the West Virginia school.
Oh, wow.
I applied for med school, and I didn't get in my first go around. I you know, alluded earlier, I'm not a great test taker, especially multiple choice questions. So I didn't do great on my MCAT scores to begin with. So I took I took the year off. I took the Kaplan course and retook the MCAT. Got my scores up enough that I got an interview, and then I got in at Pikeville, which was when I went to visit. That became where I really wanted to go, and it was close to home. It was a 2-hour drive from where my parents were there, so it wasn't too far away. It was a little closer than what the West Virginia school was.
Mm-hmm. So you get into Pikeville with the good Dr. Stiles there. What was your experience like in that first year of medical school, and particularly with the OMM lecture and lab?
Well, I feel like I'm a broken record here. There's another big long story in the mix of all
stories
of that.
Are great.
Right. So I was just excited. And like I had said before, I was very introverted. So I just kind of kept to myself. I was very quiet. I had to really concentrate and focus. And then we started out with gross anatomy lab right away. Well, you know, that formaldehyde smell is just not good for people who suffer from migraines. So I really had a rough time. But from the get-go, I mean, just listening to Dr. Stiles and how he was talking about OMT, it just lit a fire in me that I had to learn all about it. And then, you know, a few weeks in, and I don't remember exactly how far into it at this time, but I went through some crazy times personally with OMT. We were in a lab and like I had all these muscle knots in my neck, and one of the undergraduate teaching fellows, when they were just, you know, palpatory skills filling, they're like, oh my goodness. So he did a little bit of HPLA and maybe some muscle energy. I don't remember the specifics now, but then we went on and their thing was strain counter strain. And my now best friend, my lab partner, she was treating a strain counter strain rib point on me on my left side, and I'm laying on the table, and all of a sudden my right arm just starts shaking, and I literally take my left hand and reach over and grab my arm. My other lab partner, he like jumped back thinking I was like trying to smack at him. So my arm just kind of had a mind of its own, and I could not physically control it. So that was really freaky and scary, but then it kind of settled down. She, you know, quit doing the strain counter strain treatment, and I just kind of laid there. And then the way he had things structured at that time, we had a morning lecture. Then we broke out. We had two different lab groups, and I was in the first lab group. And then in the evening after both lab groups, then we went back to another hour summary lecture over what we had done in lab on whatever the techniques were that we were doing. So we went back that evening, and I still was not feeling right. I just had this weird body sensation about me. So afterwards, my two lab partners and myself, we went up to him, and I just said, because he ironically lectured that morning about, you know, you have to not get the body ahead of where it needs to be, that you can do too much at one time and you can overtreat and you can cause treatment reactions. And so I go up to him and said, Dr. Stiles, I think maybe I was overtreated and having a treatment reaction like you talked about. And he's like, oh, really? What makes you say that? And, you know, told him what had happened. So he took me back to lab. My two lab partners, they went with me, and he screened me out and started treating me. And I, again, started having these, like, pseudo seizure-like activities, fully mentally aware of what was going on, but I had no physical control of it. But he never wearied away from taking his hands off of me. It never scared him. He just talked me through. So what are you feeling? And what does this bring out? And then doing functional on me and letting things just unwind, I went back through some of the motions that we perceive it was probably how I flew through the air with the car accident. And this, you know, he had to treat me multiple over the course of a period of time, but I started having times that, oh my goodness, my head doesn't hurt. And even my classmates, if any of them listen to this, that I think they'll agree, from I kind of had a personality change from first year to second year. Maybe not necessarily a personality change, but I came out of my shell. I began, like, interacting and talking, and I joined, you know, SOMA, and I started doing all these extra things that I never would have been able to have done before, because it just was too much energy just to focus on what I needed to focus on. So I went through a whole lot of crazy treatment periods of time, even to the point that I did go to the ER at one point just to make sure there wasn't something else going on. And all that got rolled out. But he stuck with me. And, you know, by the time I was in my second year, towards the end of it, like, I would have significant amounts of time without a headache. And that was, I mean, you know, that's just a wonderful, wonderful, miraculous thing to me compared to where I had been. So, you know, it was scary time for my parents, scary time. I mean, thankfully my two lab part, my, you know, my best friend and our other, they stuck right by me. They never, you know, wrote me off as, you know, being crazy, because in everything that was going on, the term conversion disorder did come up. Have an amount of that, you know, the conversion disorder is just that, your brain takes over. It's not a physical thing that you can control. But, you know, Dr. Stiles always tells people when I'm around that I've had two educations, one from the patient side and going through so many different things, and then one from the educational side. So I truly believe that, you know, not only is Dr. Stiles my greatest mentor, but he's my saving angel to get me to persevere to the DO that I am today.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense why you have such a respect and admiration for Dr. Stiles now. Yeah, I understand it a little much better. So when you were talking about that right arm kind of having a mind of its own, you kind of touched on maybe some conversion disorder, but it also sounds like there's a component of the trauma of you getting hit by that car, and that was somehow, you know, stored in your body and was somehow being released through osteopathic manipulation. Is that what is your take on that?
That is my take. And that is something that when I teach and with the residents, you know, you have to always let people know that there's always a chance that those sort of things can happen. You can term them as a treatment reaction, but it is a treatment reaction, but sometimes it's a positive treatment reaction. You know, if a force goes in something, if you blow a balloon up and you keep putting more and more air in, at some point, it's going to reach a point that it can't handle anymore. And what happens? It pops. So, you know, when you have, whether it be emotional trauma or physical trauma, if all of that gets stored in the body and keeps building up and building up, at some point, it's got to disperse somewhere. So with me, all of that physical and emotional stuff, I think it just dispersed. I have neck pain and back pain, all of which are not continuous now. At one point, they hurt all the time. But it was the headaches. Like my brain could never heal from the concussion that I know that I, because it just, it wasn't allowed to, because it had too much force in there that it didn't have anywhere else to go. So as you start releasing all of these somatic dysfunctions, these hindrances in the body, and the body's trying to get back to its normal innately, sometimes that can happen. And it has happened to patients that I have treated, or I have had other residents have patients that's had some kind of reaction like that. So it is important to be aware of that. So I don't have any embarrassment in any part of my story. It's what's made me who I am today. I jokingly sometimes say that there's not a pain or emotion that patients can kind of describe, even when they get out there and they're describing really weird sensations, because in some shape or form throughout my life, I've pretty well felt all of that in some shape or form. Mm-hmm. So, and in a way, I think it allows me to connect to patients. And maybe that's part of why I get good results with them, but I just feel like it's so important that people realize that, and it doesn't, and if someone starts having a reaction like that, the worst thing you can do is jerk your hands off of their body if you're touching them, because that body needs to feel, protected. It needs to feel that, because if you have all that force and it's trying to figure out where it needs to go, it needs help. It needs guidance. But if you get scared, and I've seen this happen too, and you quickly, come off of their system, that's another shock to the system, because the system doesn't even know how to respond. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. It does. And I've got a few follow-up questions, because I do absolutely believe that physical, emotional, sexual trauma does get stored in our body. My question is, have you found any patterns of where certain trauma gets stored in the body? Like that's the treatment reaction, as you described it, of that right arm just shaking uncontrollably and you having no conscious control over it. It seems like that was the trauma from the motor vehicle accident when you were 12 years old. Why is there any, can we rationalize at all why it was the arm? Why wasn't it the leg? Why wasn't it the sacrum? Is there any pattern, or is that beyond our understanding at this point?
I don't think that you can pinpoint that. Each patient is their own unique, there's infinite ways that each single trauma for any individual patient can affect the body. So because it was my arm, for me, the exact same thing could be, a finger in someone else, or their neck or their leg. I don't think you can quantify it that way. I think it's a matter of real, it's all individualized. Mm-hmm. And the same thing is, like, if you can have a million different ways that you have something going on in your low back that's causing you low back pain. Mm-hmm. So to say that it's always going to be that way, it's not going to be that way. And I mean, I've seen that over and over. I think probably if you were going to correlate any one particular thing, I would say that probably it's the fibromyalgia. Mm-hmm. As I have yet to encounter a patient that has a diagnosis of fibromyalgia, has tissues that match all the classic things that we usually feel and see with fibromyalgia, that has not at some point in their life had a physical or emotional major trauma.
Yeah. So that's been my experience as well.
When you start asking, because they're not going to offer it, you have to kind of pry for it and go back to it. Sometimes they can't find anything. Sometimes in the mix of treatments, the story comes out. But I have yet to have anyone that could not match that up at some point. So I would think your the biggest consistent thing would be that. But, and of course, fibromyalgia is much more common in females than it is in males. You see it a lot more in females.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, but yeah, you know, migraines is a, you know, there's a genetic component to migraines. There's a trauma history of migraines. There's an unknown. Why do people get migraines? They're constantly studying it. Thank goodness they keep coming out with more and more medicines for treatment of it. But it's, there's so much we still don't know about why some people have headaches and why others never have headaches. So yeah, the body is just, you know, it's amazing.
Yeah.
The more we learn, the more we realize we don't even, we're not even touching the surface.
Yeah. Another question. I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this, but it's related to reproducing the mechanism of the physical trauma. So you said you were hit by a car. I don't remember if it was your left or right shoulder that went through the mirror on the car.
It was actually my left hip caught the, I was, it threw me up in the air. They say I somersaulted and my left hip caught the mirror, but I landed on my right side. My whole right side of my body is what I hit the ground full force with.
So in your mind as an osteopathic physician, how important is it to really understand the mechanics of the, I guess in your case, the physical injury? And when you're treating the person, I'm thinking about the fascial distortion model. Sometimes they almost kind of recreate the mechanism of injury in like loading, for example, loading forces, compression. How important, I guess my first question is understanding the mechanism of action. And then is there anything as regards to treatment of reproducing or unwinding the mechanism of injury?
Well, I think that the answer to that question is going to depend on what paradigm of osteopathy are you coming from and treating. And the paradigm that I work out of most of the time, and not all the time, but most of the time, is Dr. Stiles's sequencing paradigm. And so every time I treat that patient, I treat them to their unique sequence. And so I screen them out. I find where the hardest infill, lack of spring, speed bump is how I teach it to students and residents. You're feeling for speed bumps. You've got where things aren't working as they should. And the one that is not working the most, that's where you start, not necessarily where the complaint of their pain is. And let the body walk you through what that patient needs, because it might be 10 treatments. You know, you might treat that patient for a year before you have some major breakthrough and things. Everyone's going to be different. So, but as long as you listen to that patient, let your hands do the talking and not your brain. You need to understand that history. You need to know it. You need to be prepared for the things that could possibly happen. Always be prepared in any patient, especially if there's any kind of physical or emotional trauma, that there could be some kind of treatment reaction during the treatment, not just after they leave with just the typical soreness or a headache and that sort of thing. Because it has happened many times. And in that even includes patients having an emotional release, of which sometimes they don't even know why they're having an emotional release. They don't know what it's with regards to. They just, you know, just start crying because they need to have that release. And it could be, you could be treating a navicular bone and they start having an emotional release. There's no exact tie. And I think it goes into the memory that our tissues and our fascia have. And as you peel those layers of the onion back and what's going on with each individual somatic dysfunctions and hindrances, the body will walk you through what it needs, because ultimately it already knows what health is. It already knows that it's going to do any and everything it can to get back to that normal health.
Yeah, that's really, I resonate a lot with what you said. I'm still figuring out how to do that. And I feel like I'll be figuring that out my whole career.
But I still figure that out myself. That's, you know, it's the practice of medicine for a reason. And it's, you know, we continue to grow and evolve. And, you know, I think that any of our mentors will tell you that they're still learning themselves. So, you know, that's what makes it fun. That's what makes it exciting. And, you know, being able to help patients and help those that they've been everywhere else and no one has given them any kind of benefit, and you're able to give them benefit. You may not make them pain free, but you can give them a quality of life that they've not had. And, you know, to patients, that can mean the world to them. It can change their life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I like what you said. You know, let your hands be your guide. Let the body, you know, walk you through what it needs. Going back to your, sorry, I keep going back to your injury. I'm talking to you and I'm really interested in it. So someone that comes to me with chronic headaches, with concussive like symptoms, I would definitely think about doing cranial work on them. Did you have any cranial work done? And if so, did that change your headaches at all?
I have had oodles of cranial work done to me. And to this day, anybody who touches my head, if I only could have a dollar for everyone that said, oh, well, I've never felt anything like that before. Oh, well, that's interesting. My system is very sensitive and I still get headaches. But to say I get a migraine that debilitates me is usually about 3 times a year. Otherwise, I can usually between getting treated or, you know, catching it in time with like ibuprofen and Excedrin and those sort of things, I can manage them. So, yeah, I lost my train of thought. Sorry.
No, so you have had cranial work and it has made a big difference in the amount of headaches and the degree of the headache.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It would be very rare that someone who suffers from headache did not have some sort of cranial dysfunction going on.
Mm-hmm. And so your experience with Dr. Stiles, your experience in medical school of your own self-healing, did that lead you to want to practice broad spectrum medicine and family medicine as well as OMM?
Yes. You know, I had already had my mindset from the time that, you know, I was 13, that I was going to be a family medicine doctor because I was out to prove that you could be better than how that doctor was to me. That was where my mindset was through all the years. It was like, it became my, you know, focus around everything that I did. But then by the time I reached my second year of medical school, I knew that I did the undergraduate teaching fellowship year. And I knew I wanted to do that. So when I applied for it, another funny little story, there was two of us that applied for it. Well, our test to see, you know, if we would be a good fit for doing it is we had to each individually treat Dr. Stiles himself. A second year medical student. And we had to treat him and talk him through what we were finding and what we were treating and why. And that was our test. Talk about nervous. My hands were shaking and sweaty and cold and clammy. But that first time, I have since, he and I have been trading treatments now for over 20 years. And I never had any nervousness after that. But yeah, that was my test. So that was a nerve-wracking evening for me. So I did do the undergraduate teaching fellowship because all of my classmates started coming to me for me to every little ache and pain or the end of lab or something. I was the one that they would start to seek out of my class. Myself and Dr. Derek Jones, who we did the undergraduate fellowship together, we were the two that everyone had already started to seek out outside of the current teaching fellows that we had. So, you know, it just kind of, we were the perfect segue to do it.
Yeah, that's great. So you did the fellowship year, Dr. Stiles. That was sneaky of him. We all love OMT. That was a good way to get some good OMT treatment.
Yeah.
What was the fellowship year like for you? What was that experience like?
The undergraduate fellowship year was awesome for me. For one, my own, you know, I was still going through a whole lot of things for my own personal growth and mental and physical being. But that's when I really fell in love with the teaching part of it, of osteopathy, and also just being able to start really picking doctor. Like Dr. Stiles would tell you that Derek Jones and myself, that we challenged him more than anybody else, because every little thing he would say, we'd say, well, you say you're doing this, but we think this is what you're really doing. So he'd ruffle his hair, take his glasses off, rub his eyes, put his glasses back on. It's like, I don't know about that. I'll have to think about that. And he lives in Lexington. So on weekends, he would go home to Lexington, and he would come back after he thought and pondered on this all weekend. And then we would just have these really detailed discussions. And he's like, I got to change my lectures now. He did that many times, and he still does that to this day, actually, with things. But we just had so much fun, because and by doing that, not only did we help him, you know, his whole goal when he took on the role of coming to Pikeville to teach is, I've got to put words to all of the things that I've learned from Dr. George Laughlin, from Fred Mitchell Sr., from Grumman, from all the people that he trained with. You know, how do I verbalize this so that I can prove that what I do is teachable, that I can teach other people to do it and do it just as well?
Yeah, that's great. What a special year to be able to work so closely with Dr. Stiles. That's wonderful. So you get into you choose family medicine. You've got to be that better than that family medicine physician who treated you when you were a child after your accident. And so you do family medicine residency. Why not strictly FM residency? Did you always want to combine FM, OMM?
After I learned that it existed, yes. And at that time, it was under the AOA accreditation, and they had two different tracks you could go. You could do, well, three different ones. You could do the integrated, which is you did a residency that was a four-year residency that integrated family medicine with the OMM. Or you could do a plus one, where you would do just your primary residency and then spend an extra year of training for the one-year residency at the end. Or they also had the residency that you would just go, you know, do an internship year and then straight your NMM. And I, as soon as I found out about that, I knew I wanted to do the integrated residency. And Pikeville, Kentucky did not have an integrated residency. They only had family medicine. And the program director at the time kept really nudging me and wanted me to come and do my residency there. I didn't do my student rotations there. I did those in Norton, Virginia. And he really wanted me. And I always, you know, I just kept saying, get the integrated program, get that up and going, and I promise I'll come. And I had even went and did a rotation at the Orlando integrated program and had intentions. That was probably where I would be my top pick and apply to. And then, but he worked with the hospital administration, and they were able to get the integrated program up and going with Dr. Stiles to help head it up, as well as one of the graduates from the first Pikeville class that did do her integrated residency in Orlando, Florida, Dr. Jennifer Parsley. And so I was in the second integrated class that they had for that residency when they started it up in Pikeville. So again, I just feel like that God has led me on this wondrous journey. It's been very rocky at times. There's been so many hiccups along the way, and where I'm at now, I never would have dreamed I would be where I'm at. But, you know, I just keep on trucking on this journey. So, and then, you know, it was great to train with Dr. Parsley and what she had learned from her residency. She then, you know, decided that she needed to move away to Wisconsin to pursue other opportunities with her medical career and what was best for her family. And then that was when Dr. Laura Griffin, who is the current chair of the OPP department at KYCOM and a former AAO president, came on, and I was able to train with her for the second half of my residency. So I had two great mentors, you know, help me through my residency and help shape me into the physician I am, in addition to the family medicine program director, Dr. Miranda. At the time, he really had a great impact on me from the medicine side. And so, you know, I'm just forever thankful for not letting that headache hinder me from going to that fair to learn about osteopathy.
Yeah, that's wonderful. You know, it's neat to just continue walking through life with the ups and downs and the trials and tribulations, the good times and the joyful times. And I feel like opportunities just will present themselves sooner or later. Can you walk us through a little bit, kind of summarize how you ended up where you are as the program director at the Ohio Health ONMM residency program?
Sure. So from the time I did the integrated residency at Pikeville, the administration at that time was already begging me to stay on as faculty when I finished the program for both the family medicine side and the NMM side. And with the plans that once I had achieved the amount of time and training that you have to have in postgraduate education to become a program director, that I would segue in as program director over the residency. Dr. Stiles always says that he just likes to teach. He hates all of the nuances of the paperwork part of it. And so he was very happy to be able to hand that over. So, you know, I continued toward that, and I did. I graduated in July of 2010. I was a little off cycle because I had my first son in my last year of my residency. And so I started on as core faculty for both family medicine and the NMM program. And then in 2015, I was then promoted to the program director over the integrated program. And then Dr. Stiles remained the program director over our plus one program because we had both options. So then we transitioned to ACGME accreditation with the merger in 2018, continued on as program director then. And then, you know, there was a lot of different things that happened. And the hospital just decided that, you know, they didn't want to continue having the residency anymore, the osteopathic neuromusculoskeletal medicine residency. And so we had to voluntarily withdraw our accreditation that we had. And at that time, you know, it was a lot of emotions of not knowing what I wanted to do, because, you know, if I stayed there, I was just seeing patients. There would be no teaching aspect to it. The KYCOM faculty begged me to come join them there. That was a very serious consideration and was in the thought processes of that. I always feel like, and tell everyone, I feel like I am a much better teacher one-on-one than I am standing in front of a large group of people, because public speaking is hard for me. It's getting much, I mean, as I lecture and do things, I am getting better with it, but I still feel like that's a struggle. And so Amber Roush with AAO actually reached out to this, the Oplenus program. They had been stagnant for a couple of years. They didn't get a program director because they were due for a site visit for continued accreditation. They risked losing their accreditation. And so she reached out to them and said, hey, I know this program director who's had to voluntarily withdraw her program. She's not a city girl, but and Athens is small, so you might have a chance. You need to reach out to her and see if she's a good fit for you all, because I think you would be a perfect match. And so the DME, Dr. Kunar, for the Ohio Health Blindness Residencies, sent me an email, and we set up a phone conversation. And then I was interviewed the very next week. And then I already knew that it felt right to me that this was where my career needed to go. But I wouldn't uproot my family till I could come for a visit. Of course, we were still in the middle of COVID, so it took a little while to coordinate all of that. And so when I came that in November, it would have been November of 2021. When we come and visited and I met with everyone in person, I literally went out to the car, got in my car, and I looked at my family, including my mother-in-law, who thought if she came with us that maybe I would say no, because she couldn't fathom the thoughts of me moving away with taking her grandbabies from her. But I just said, this is where I'm supposed to be. I just know that this is where God wants me. So that was kind of what led me here. And then, you know, here I have had to come on, and I wouldn't abandon. I had Dr. Yvonne Yang was my very last resident at Pikeville. She didn't graduate till June of, 2022. So I would not leave her. So, you know, I told them I want the job and I want to come, but I can't come until after June 30th. I have a resident that I have to see through. And plus the family medicine residents that I was core faculty for, I was not going to leave them. So they had no problem with that. And they actually were able to ACGME postpone the site visit for a year to give time for me as program director to get here, to get the program back up and going. I was fortunate enough to have a resident, Dr. Wade Booker, who reached out and was interested in coming to do the residency. And we had a phone conversation and an interview, and he was willing to take a chance on me. And he was willing to wait a couple of months to start, because I didn't even start till the end of July, and residency start dates are the beginning of July. So to take a chance on me and me to this program up and going, and we had lots of growing pains, but we have come so far. I now have my second resident, and my first resident has now just he's getting ready to finish where he was off cycle, and he is going to remain on as teaching faculty with me, and as well as teaching faculty for HCOM. So I'm super excited about that.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So, if you want to talk a little bit, Dr. Kingery, about the program, and I know that was one of the plugs that you wanted to make, so maybe this is a good opportunity.
Right, sure, yeah. So our Ohio Health of Blindness Hospital has the ONMM 3 residency program. We have 3 accredited spots for that. So the ONMM residency is kind of a confusing process. It's one residency that you can enter in 3 different pathways. So there's an ONMM 1, an ONMM 2, and an ONMM 3. So the ONMM 3, for a better understanding, is pretty well, think of it in terms as kind of the equivalent of what the old plus 1 residency program was in the AOA. So you've completed a primary residency, whether, most of the time it's with osteopathic recognition, and it could be in family medicine, pediatrics, internal medicine, or any primary residency. And then you come after you graduate from that residency, then you segue directly into the 1-year ONMM residency. And then you'll have a dual board certification.
Isn't that considered fellowship?
Nope. We are a residency. It is not a fellowship, and it functions as a residency. So as a residency, you still have rotations. You have certain rotations that are requirements. The nice thing is, such as if you do a family medicine residency and you do sports medicine. Sports medicine is one of the selective requirements that you have to have had to be able to graduate from the residency program. But if you had that sports medicine rotation as part of your primary residency, then we can continue to count that as meeting that requirement in our standards, and that gives you an opportunity to do an elective in place of that in your blocks of rotations, just for an example.
Yeah, I see. Okay, and then you have the ONMM1, the ONMM2. So if you started the first year, that's going to be a 3-year residency?
Correct. Like, so the ONMM1 would be that you would do like your traditional kind of internship, and then followed by 2 years of ONMM where you would, completing different rotations and all the required specialties, and then your electives, and then your inpatient. You have to do inpatient consults, and you have so much continuity clinic time for OMT that you see patients for. And then the ONMM2 would be, let's say that you did your internship somewhere else and decide that you don't want to, you just want to do the ONMM program. You don't want to do like a primary residency and then ONM, then you could then take on the ONMM 2 year.
Got it.
If you did your, in the old terms, the internship year, it's your PGY 1 year elsewhere, then, or even at the same program, you could segue in, because let's say like if you were in a family medicine residency or internal medicine, you completed that first year, even if it's at the same facility, then you wanted to transition to an accredited ONMM2 spot, then your next 2 years would just be meeting the requirements for the NMM residency.
Got it. Okay. Well, that's exciting. That's awesome that you took on that role and revived that program. We're in need of a great, well-educated, well-trained ONMM physician. So thanks for doing that.
Yeah. So anyone that's in residency right now that's interested, it's well worth taking an extra year of time. And my core faculty and I would love the opportunity to take your osteopathic skills, understanding of the principles, and just the ability to integrate it into your career to the next level. Pretty well all of the DO medical schools are desperately in need of more NMM boarded faculty. So the door could be wide open to moving anywhere in the country to further your skills, especially if you have a big interest in academic teaching.
Yeah. Any other perks of the program that you wanted to mention?
We're a small town, but we're an hour and a half from Columbus, and we're about an hour and a half from Charleston, West Virginia, 45 minutes from Parkersburg, West Virginia. So you get all of the small town feels with easy accessibility to the bigger city life for the things that you need. This area is very open, very receptive to OMT. For my clinical, I have no open availability until December. My resident that just started July 1, she is already booked out until the end of October. And we have a wait list that's huge and a referral list that's huge that we're trying to work through and keep patients on the schedule. So the volume and the need is here.
Yeah.
Right. And I have Dr. Williams, and then Dr. Wachowski has just joined on as core faculty, and then my resident's graduating, Dr. Booker, he's going to be. So I have 3 core faculty now, and so you're going to get a diversity of different approaches to patients and how to treat. And I always say you can never have too many tools in your tool bag, because you never know when one particular tool is exactly what you need for that patient, and it may be something that you've not done for 10 years. So it's very important that you get a broad education and you know, everyone has something to add. We all have the techniques that we're better at than others. So it's like everything else in life, you know, there's some things we're better at than others. So I think that, you know, bodes well. We have a great working relationship with HCOM and also with the family medicine residency here. We actually do a combined didactics once a month where that my O&M residents help lead and act as, you know, mentors and help teach different osteopathic skills and work with them. And the family medicine residents love it. They love that interaction that we have.
Yeah, that's fantastic. We do something similar with the internal medicine residents as well as the family medicine residents. We have the statewide campus system through MSU. They'll come a few times a year and we'll have afternoon seminars for them. So I think that inter-specialty overlap, working together, sharing your specialty, particularly OMM, because I found, you know, a lot of the DOs don't know how to bill for OMM or just have forgotten a lot of the skills that they learned in medical school, and really do appreciate that, the teaching. So wonderful. Dr. Kinger, you were going to make another plug as well for an upcoming course.
Oh yeah. So I'm helping teach and table train at the Laughlin Still Functional course that's going to be led by Dr. Ed Stiles and Dr. Charlie Beck. It's going to be September 29th through October 1st, and it's going to be at WVSOM. They're sponsoring as part of their alumni CME. There are still spots available for anyone who would like to plan a last minute CME. It is going to be available for 21 AOA credits. And you're going to have, there's going to be at least six of us table training, and to help learn the functional, as Dr. Stiles has always taught it, that he learned from Dr. Laughlin, which was A.T. Stiles' grandson. And so if you're interested, there's still availability to sign up. And if you go to the wvsom.edu website under their CME events, there is information of how you can register for that.
Okay. Yeah. And hopefully I can include the link in the show notes. So if people are interested, they can click on that link and sign up. Anything else, Dr. Kingery, that you wanted to share? Stories, advice?
You know, just follow your heart with what you want to do, regardless of what it is in medicine. But you know, if you have a heart and a passion for ONT, it doesn't have to be my program, but don't give up on it. Follow it, especially if you're doing a primary residency. I mean, look at all the years of education that we have. In the grand scheme of things, what's another year of training to have a dual board certification and the career opportunities that can open up for you, especially if you have any interest in teaching. And or even just focusing on the musculoskeletal system with patients, you know, don't bypass it and really embrace it, and you know, continue to learn. It's a life. I mean, I learn just as much from my residents as I'm able to teach them, sometimes even more. So that's how we grow and develop and continue the legacy of osteopathy so that we can keep it growing.
Yeah. And I mean, I have to thank you, because I learned a lot from you at Convo. Every time I do cranial, I think of you. I'm like, okay, this is what palpating the cranium should feel like. So yeah.
Right. That was a lot of fun. And that, you know, with you, the biggest thing is we just had to teach you to let your hands relax and blend into the tissues. If you just slowly blend in, then the patient's system will just say, oh, well, come on in. Let me show you what's going on. So, yeah, that was a lot of fun. It was great working with you. And I just really appreciate you, you know, thinking enough of me to invite me.
Yeah, the podcast has been so much fun, and such a wealth of information and knowledge and clinical pearls And there's so much to learn from everybody that comes on the podcast. And I really appreciate you sharing your clinical pearls, sharing your experience, the experience of your accident and how that kind of led you to medicine and osteopathy. And I'm just being a phenomenal physician. So yeah, thanks so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
May I include your email in the show notes? So if people have questions or would like to reach out to you, they can do that.
Sure. Yeah, that's no problem.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, thanks again for your time, Dr. Kingery, and have a wonderful evening. I guess I'll see you at Convo in March.
That is the plan. I'll be there. Okay. As we say in Appalachia, Lord willing, the creek don't rise.
Lord willing, the creek. Yes, Lord willing, the creek don't rise. We'll see you in Colorado Springs in March.
That sounds wonderful.
Okay, have a great evening.
All right, you too. Thank you. Bye.
Hope you took some clinical pearls from this conversation. The importance of keen, attentive listening to the person, allowing our hands and knowledge of anatomy to guide us to the dysfunction, and to never underestimate the power of example. If you would like to reach out to Dr. Kingery, you may at jennifer.kingery@ohiohealth.com. You can find her email in the show notes. Check out the course, the Functional Techniques Still and Laughlin course from September 29th through October 1st. The link is in the show notes. And as well, reach out to the podcast with any questions or people you'd like to hear from on the podcast at onmmpodcast@gmail.com.